This is Otto Mueller responding to a letter from Barry Tetcher concerning the UWA History Project and covering the time that I was at University of Wisconsin. I arrived in Madison at the university in the fall of 1935. After having graduated from high school in June of 1950 from Aberdeen, South Dakota, then spent a year and a half at the South Dakota State College, a year and a half in Washington, D.C., working and going to prep school, and a year in the United States Army at Fort Monroe, Virginia. Then a year at the United States Military Academy at West Point. The next 4 years, while I was working and taking reduced course schedule, I graduated in June 1939 with an ROTC commission and a BA degree. I was classified as an advanced standing sophomore and chose to major in political science with the thought of getting into city government and as a city manager. The courses I took from the Department of Political Science related to this idea of city management. J.T. Salter was a city government expert, and I took two courses from him. John Goss was in public administration. Chester Lloyd-Jones taught cooperatives. Llewellyn Foncooken was in U.S. government, and I didn't take a course from him until graduate school. Egbert Wingert taught constitutional law. One of the most popular courses was one taught by William Ebenstein on contemporary dictators. I considered all these men excellent teachers and interesting personalities. I remember J.T. Salter standing at the blackboard illustrating point in city government and standing to erase a misspelled word by using his sleeve, and this was a characteristic of the way he erased the blackboard. Salter liked to involve the students and make them do most of the talking in class and when reporting on their reading diaries. Most of the other men were excellent lecturers, and most of the time were talking to the student. I got a job almost immediately through the NYA, working on projects connected with the student union. Charles Dollard, associate director of the union, was the person who hired me. My first job was supervising a toboggan slide that was on Observatory Hill, going down to the lake on the present site of Elizabeth Waters Hall. another student by the name of Bill Exum, and I were the two toboggan slide attendants. And by the way, Exum was the only black student that I ever met in the university, and I believe was the only black in the graduating class of 1937. We also worked on equipment of the Hoofers Outing Club, and did other jobs in the student activities area in the workshop. One Christmas recess, I posed and acted as a model for Jim Walkers when he was drawing sketches for the Paul Bunyan murals. And today I have two of these rather large sketches which were given to me by Porter Butts at the time of the 50th anniversary of the Wisconsin Union. My immediate supervisor was Charlie Owens, and my next job was at the student desk. I felt being advanced from my 25 cents an hour NYA job to a 35 cents an hour student desk clerk, part-time. Henry Herman was also in one of these jobs down at the entrance to the cafeteria where he sold newspapers and candy each night before and during the dinner hour. In addition to working at the desk at the Union in the main lobby, I would from time to time be working on setups for the art gallery, projects in the workshop, ushering in the theater, and acting as an attendant in the library. I recall the concert committee was responsible for the big concerts that were held in the Stock Pavilion, and ushering at Helen Jepsen, Richard Crooks, Paul Ropes, and Marian Anderson concerts. Also during this period, the National Progressive Party was launched at the Stock Pavilion with Phil LaViolette, the candidate for president. These were very exciting times for undergraduate students as the political leaders from around the country would come to talk and politic campaign on the campus. There were over 100 student workers, mostly men, who were working for food coupons at that point in the fall of 35, 36, 37. Later we were paid in cash, but many of these students considered themselves in a family of student workers, and as a result there was a good deal of camaraderie among them. The thought came to us that it would be well to see if we could live together. And at that time, the dormitories were being expanded, and we petitioned to occupy one of the halls as a cooperative, where we would only have to take a housing contract and not a food contract in the residence hall. This appealed to D.L. Halverson, who was the director of dormitories and commons, later changed to Division of Residence Halls. I had taken a course in cooperatives and was familiar with the Rochdale principles of cooperatives, which is a work cooperative, and on this basis organized a house council and officers to operate a residence like Mack House. Mack House originally was Unit C. No names had been attached to the houses. When it was named for the state Supreme Court Chief Justice Mack, the other three houses initially built, Gilman and Turner, were as well also named. In Mack House, although there were primarily men who were working for their food coupons and later cash at the union and jobs in food service, there were two out-of-state freshmen admitted as residents in the program and were oriented to the purposes and the idea of the program, and seemed to have done very well in the first year of its operation. The work I took in graduate school was primarily pointed toward qualifying me as a manager of a student union, a residence halls program, a club, a resident club, or an institution of that kind. There was no formal degree in institutional management, but at that point I felt that the city government, city manager point of view was a little too broad, and I wanted to bring it down to something I felt I could handle. So the courses I chose were those that were available in food service and in administration. One was Home Economics 122, that was called Tea Room Management. I also chose to take a course in group work theory and practice from Professor Helen Clark, which I felt would be a good activities type of program if I would get an assignment in a neighborhood house type of institution. I never got by that, past that 1 year of graduate work, so I really don't know what I would go for after that, but I do feel that these courses helped me in my work for the Division of Residence Halls, Housing Bureau, and my later position as Director of Housing and Food Services at Penn State. John Halverson and Lee Burns were supervising the food management course that I took. The first year, the room only fee at Mack House was $27 a semester. The men did all the janitor work and all the operational maintenance in the house. As an element of their work cooperative. I had been elected chairman of the house, which amounted to the house fellow assigned in other houses. There were 80 men in the house, and we divided the into three floors, first, second, and third, who had a leader, group leader, in each area. And they were members of a house council, which determined the policies and operations of the house within whatever limitations were placed on us by the director of dormitories and commons. At the end of the first semester in Unit C, Mack House, I was asked to take over the fellow appointment in Turner House, as that fellow was dropping out of the program and continued through till June of 1939. As the house fellow at Turner House. The next year, I was appointed fellow in Sharman House, which had been opened in the fall, along with four other houses, Swenson, Jones, Chamberlain, and Conover. They made up the eight halls that comprised the Cronsage group. By this time, I was fairly deeply involved with the household program, and as it was expanded, I was appointed as a graduate house fellow to direct and supervise the program. This was in the fall of 1940. In the meantime, I was married, and which led to the organization of a house in the summer term for married students, in which my wife, my bride, and I supervised. There had been a need for housing for young married couples who were teachers mostly, and we were willing to try this 40-couple, 80-person house in Gilman, and Gilman was chosen because the residence hall library was in the ground level of that building and provided additional activity space for the married couples. We lived in the fellow's room and performed most of the duties that the fellows were responsible to provide in the regular men's housing units. However, much of the program in the summertime was of a social nature, and the athletic programs were pushed very hard. Tennis, golf, softball, horseshoes, anything that would provide activity for the married students and their wives, taking trips to Taliesin, for example, Blue Mounds, Little Norway, places of this character as interest spots for the married student wives. Up to this point, Norris Wentworth had been the on-site manager, leader of the House Fellows program, the student programs, doing the assignments in the Tripp and Adams Falls. In the fall of 1940, with the crunch age being in full swing, Arnie Damon was hired and I was appointed to help Wentworth with the overall program. At the same time, Elizabeth Waters Hall was opening for women. Damon's responsibilities had to do with the student activities programs and the student governments in the halls, both men and women, working with the house fellows and the head residents in the halls. My job was to be in charge of the house fellow program, training, selection, supervision, and also to be responsible for the assignments of students within the halls. Norris Wentworth, coached me and trained me in the assignment job. His interest in that point was to move to a position that was opening at the University of Illinois, which he later accepted. Referring to your House Fellow questionnaire, Attachment B, becoming a House Fellow, I guess you could say if living in a hotel for a year and a half, earning your room and board while I was attending South Dakota State College, and in a prep school, boarding school, for 6 months, and in an army barracks for 1 year, in the United States Military Academy for 1 year, I probably qualify of having lived in a residence hall. As for becoming a fellow, I was chosen after my work as the chairman of the Cooperative House, Mac House, to be a fellow in Turner House. Usual procedure is to make application in a formal application blank to a faculty committee for an individual interview. Faculty committee was made up of a half a dozen people, all of whom were outstanding professors or administrators of the university. Porter Butts, Dr. Harold Bradley, Dr. Otto Kowalki, Don Halverson, Walter Agard, and Dick Husband. These men were very perceptive when it comes to knowing and questioning young men who were applying for house fellows. After they were chosen and notified in the early spring, the year preceding their appointment, they went through an indoctrination conference with the existing house fellows and the graduate house fellow. They were told exactly what their assignment would be, and in what house they would be operating. One of the most important facts of training indicated that to know their residence and to be a part of the house program were the two most important elements of their job. Each house fellow was provided with a blue book, so-called a house fellow's Bible, which outlined all the facilities, procedures, and tactics to be used in their house fellow work. There was a personal history sheet for each resident who was assigned to their house. And it was most important that this personal history sheet was completed by a personal interview with each resident within the first 10 days of the semester. The freshmen came in a day or two ahead of the upperclassmen, and we had our own orientation within the residence halls program. One of the feature speakers at one point in the orientation was Harry Stuhldreher, and on the program with him was Ray Dvorak. Ray would get the men to group singing Wisconsin songs, and Stuhldreher would give them an inspiring "Let's Get the Job Done in College" talk. While on the job, a house fellow knew from the beginning that it was his responsibility to know his residents thoroughly, and thereby fitting them into some extracurricular endeavor while they were pursuing their academic program. Each house initially would have a house meeting and regularly thereafter. Each resident knew that his counselor was operating on a basis of walk in and see me when you need to. And the rights of all residents within the house were emphasized as a house rule. There never a day passed that a resident would not have some reason to contact his fellow. And by the same token, there'd be almost at every day there'd be some reason for a house fellow to get in touch with one of the residents. Keeping in track of the freshman's progress in his academic program, getting his grades, and counseling on academic pursuits was one of the problems. Discipline, I would say, generally was not needed if these other programs went forward. But at times there were events that caused some concern. Pranks such as dropping water bombs from the third floor to the residents coming and going at the entrances. A trick practiced by some of the residents in houses in the Tripp Adams area where there was a fireplace in the den was to get a roll of toilet paper on a windy night, hold it under the draft of the fireplace and let the toilet paper run up the chimney, and as it got up the chimney to light it, then the paper would go out and float through the air burning. Also, snowballing within the quadrangles where more often a window or a screen was a target to be hit and damaged. It was like a hit and run. Who did it? Quiet hours were enforced, and this was one of the more difficult things to keep in hand, particularly when a house fellow absents himself in the evening from the house. But usually the chairman or president of the house took responsibility during these periods. Activity programs for the house and for the halls in general were wide and varied. Each house had a special banquet each year at the Union, in which they invited a speaker or guest. Also, guests were invited to have dinner in the dining rooms. And each year, each house had a picnic, usually on the lakefront or at the picnic point. The activity were spread over clubs such as the camera club, barbell club, workshop, dorm chorus, the bookstore, the library, town hall speakers meetings, touch football, basketball, softball, exchange dinners, Sunday night dinners, candlelight. Normally, Sunday night was not a mealtime except for the special candlelight dinners. Bowling teams and even a four-man crew. Student government in each house resulted from the president, secretary, treasurer, social chairman, and athletic chairman being active in each house, and the house president's council, the overall student government in the area, set policy for all other student programs. The dining rooms in the Trippin Adams area was known as the refectory, and later named Van Nuys Hall. There was a dress code for the evening meal, coat and tie. Tables were assigned by seat and by house, and the house fellow would see to it that there was a head of table in each unit. Table conversation was varied, but usually there was no need to stimulate this. As in all areas where food is eaten regularly at the same place, there were times toward the end of the semester when there were complaints about the same old menu and the quality of food. But generally, I would classify the food beyond average, and certainly of quality, and served very well by student waiters. Tables were set usually for family type service. As time went on and the population grew, it was possible, and the costs escalated, it was impossible to continue the dinner table service, and all meals were served cafeteria. In fact, the new residence halls were designed on the basis of cafeteria service only. And this was one of the reasons for, on a Sunday night, having a candlelight dinner, which was a voluntary program. backup staff for the residence halls were most supportive, particularly D.L. Halverson, who set the tone for the whole program. His associate, Lee Burns, also was most supportive to all hostel programs. Mrs. Beulah Daly and Mrs. Catherine Henning were the dietitians in Van Hees and Cronsage and had their problems, but particularly with student employment being at mealtime. We tried to employ, being ready at mealtime, we tried to employ as many students as possible in the dining rooms and in the kitchens. So going to the dining room regularly, the hospitals had a chance to contact these dietitians regularly. Merle Jackson and Einar Anderson were the maintenance supervisors, and when we were in Mac House in the cooperative houses, we had to work, the chairman had to work, and the work chairman had to see and work with Mr. Jackson regularly. As far as I know and knew, the house fellow program at the University of Wisconsin was a singular type of program. I knew of no other college or university who was using exactly the same type of student supervision and house leadership. Many of them followed the pattern of house counselors or head residents in the units, more from a supervision point of view rather than a point of view of stimulating activities and programs. As for composition of the house and by classes, there was an attempt made to have a distribution of all classes in each house. For example, the ideal combination would be to have 40% freshmen, 30% sophomores, 20% juniors, and 10% seniors. It was difficulty in maintaining this distribution when men chose to stay in the house they had originally been assigned to. However, graduation and attrition from dropouts and change of heart and going off campus usually created the sufficient vacancy for the 40% freshmen. I would say that D.L. Halverson's farsightedness in developing a program of expansion of residence halls at Wisconsin probably led to the events that you could consider milestones. Expansion of the first halls beyond Tripp and Adams, those of the Cronsage, and the success of these units, not only as normal residence halls but as cooperatives, also is significant. After Mac House had proven its worth as a cooperative living unit and a method of reducing costs to the resident, three more houses were declared to be cooperative: Swenson, Jones, and Gilman. When I think of some of the personalities that were invited by the students to be dinner guests, the names of Sinclair Lewis, Martha Ray, Lawrence Welk, Cab Calloway come to mind. Of course, there were many faculty who accepted dinner invitations. Most of the aforementioned faculty committee at one time or another. Usually they spoke to a group of the residents after the dinner. Jim Watrous, Jack Keenitz, Jack Van Cort, all from the area of art education, have been guests at several times. Even Chuck Fenske, the outstanding miler for Wisconsin, who later was a vice president, I believe, of Oscar Mayer Company. Also, I reminded that many of the house fellows in later life made great contributions to their profession and to the university. For example, Norman Becker, who was president of the Alumni Association, and Bob Schilling, Dr. Schilling, who developed the Schilling test for pernicious anemia, and Nat Heffernan, who is a judge in the Superior Court, John Reynolds, who turned out to be governor. Considerable number of others who don't come to mind at the moment. The building of Elizabeth Waters Hall and the opening in the summer of 1940 was a significant boost to the social programs in the men's hall through dating, partying, and exchange dinners. The fraternity house program was always a competition for good residents and active activity residents in the halls, and usually a good percentage of the freshmen who left the halls went to fraternities. I'm thinking of some men like Ed Fleming, Edwin Newman, Bob Chaplin, who later all made their mark in journalism. Toward the end of 1941, there was every indication that there were some difficult times ahead for the residence halls, as the men had to register for the draft. And people might, like myself, had to be prepared for active duty. And in March of 1942, both Arne Damon and I were ordered to active duty, with thoughts of hopefully returning when it was all over. Don Howerson, Lee Burns, and other staff people at the residence halls kept in touch with us throughout the war, and we were very pleased to feel that if and when we got back, we'd have a place to go. When I returned to Madison in late 1945, one of my first visits was with Don Howerson. He in turn took me in to see A.W. Peterson, who was vice president of business, and the two of them said, "We have an idea that you could be very helpful to us if you took a position which we are creating to help with our expectations of a heavy demand for housing from veterans as they return to campus. We are going to establish a housing bureau, and we'd like you to be the director of the bureau. We're giving you a free hand in organizing it, setting it up, and making recommendations to us for your needs. Well, I had an idea I would go back to the Division of Residence Halls and work in a house fellow program. But their proposition sounds so challenging that I chose to take it and become the first director of the first housing bureau at University of Wisconsin. However, there had been an ongoing housing program, one in the Dean of Men's office, one in the Dean of Women's office. Each office supervising sororities or fraternities, and each office having a rooming house program to accommodate those students who chose to live independently. This was had been, and was after World War II, an ongoing program. However, with other problems related to the housing of students and not related to the housing of students, the deans of men and women had many other problems to face with the veterans' return. So the responsibilities that had been vested in the Dean of Men's office and the Dean of Women's office were transferred to the Housing Bureau as it related to housing placement, supervision, quality of housing, standards, and so forth. So the first element of all approved housing were those houses that had end of tape on the first side and starting the second side of tape. The Housing Bureau's offices were in a former woman's residence that had been owned and operated by the university through the Dean of Women's office. It was across from the what was the library school, and what before the library school happened to be my brother's fraternity in 1932 that passed out of existence, and the housing house corporation sold to the university. It was right next to the faculty club. The supervisors for housing in Dean of Men's and Dean of Women's office, Mrs. Blanche Stem, and Mrs. Helen Engel, respectively, were transferred to the Housing Bureau. In addition to these people, the staff consisted of two housing inspectors, Mrs. Paff and Mrs. Hardy, and three clerical. The main responsibilities of the Housing Bureau were to increase the supply and stock of housing by solicitation and establishing new types of space. Standards were established for approved housing, and the inspection service continued with the fraternities and sororities. In addition, a liaison was established with the city health inspector and the city code inspector for compliance with city requirements. In the student government areas, the Dean of Women's Office, with the staff member Helen Kaiser, was the advisor to sororities, and Bill Blazer and Ted Zillman were advisor to the fraternities. Off-campus housing, before the Housing Bureau was established, was conducted by staff in the Dean of Women's Office and the Dean of Men's Office. Blanche Stem, Susan Davis, Zoe Bayless, Helen Engel did an excellent job of maintaining off-campus placement for men and women. However, at the time the war ended, the numbers involved far exceeded the ability of the staff to handle them. And this is one of the main reasons for Mr. Halverson and Mr. Peterson suggesting that a central housing bureau be established. After a set of standards had been agreed upon and published, and the inspection service established, regular and continuing inspections were made of all student housing properties that were to be approved and listed by the university. In addition, the individual room listings were available, and no inspections were made of accommodations in private homes. Landlords in the approved housing program and housing supervision in these rooming houses, they were treated to educational meetings at the beginning, during, and at the end of each year. At the time I left the Housing Bureau in September of 1953, President Fred had appointed a special advisory committee to help the acting director of the Housing Bureau, Mrs. Stem. I've enclosed the report of this committee, which I think will be helpful in determining the character of services that were being performed by the Housing Bureau. I recall an incident during the first year of our operation, when many veterans were coming in to seek housing. A young man appeared in my office in his Eisenhower jacket, and you could see that he was very much impressed with his veteran status. I attempted to gain some rapport with him by saying, well, that I was a veteran also, and he looked at me and said, "What war?" With that, I decided that I should keep my information questions to the requests at hand. The Housing Bureau, the director of the Housing Bureau, reported directly to the Vice President of Business for the university. D.L. Halverson was Assistant Business Manager, and his offices were in the old administration building, which was immediately adjacent to the Housing Bureau's office. the Greek housing and the Division of Residence Halls, as I mentioned, were considered a part of the overall approved housing stock of the university, and therefore were subject to the standards for student housing which were set up at the time the Housing Bureau opened. Inspection of these properties continued throughout the time the Housing Bureau was operating, and I assume after, in some respect, because a liaison had been established with the City Code and Health Office. And Mr. Burt, I recall, was in charge of the City of Madison's Housing and Health Departments. During the war, a number of the fraternities had closed, and some of the properties had been sold to private operators, who in turn opened them as housing units for women students. These units, after the Housing Bureau was established, fell under its aegis for standards and inspections. Among the more prominent off-campus women's housing that continued were Langdon Hall, Ann Emery Hall, Villa Marie, Jordan, Tabard Inn, and several other smaller women's approved houses. In addition to those fraternities that had turned to approved housing by private operation. As director of the Housing Bureau, I was appointed to the Student Life and Interest Committee and served on two of the subcommittees, one Society, Fraternities, and Politics, which had to do primarily with the conduct and student government and living programs within the student body. Because organized housing, such as the residence halls and fraternities, were a major issue in the student life, my responsibilities were primarily that of checking out the scheduling of events to see that there would not be conflicts, and to help with the general operations of these housings through this type of housing through standards and inspection service. The other subcommittee was living conditions and hygiene. This was primarily associated with the inspection service and the standards set for approved housing on the campus and off campus, in addition to the aiding students with landlord housing relationships. The lists of members of these two subcommittees that you furnished me pretty much indicate the interests of the members of the committee by field titles. Dr. John Brown was particularly supportive of operation of the Housing Bureau's inspection service. Earlier, as a student, I had worked part-time over Christmas recess for Dr. Jerry Rolick, then a graduate student in hydraulic sanitary engineer, reading oxygen utilization in his experiments. 1950s when he returned to university as a professor. In 1951, he became the chairman of the Student Life Committee on Society, Fraternities, and Politics. In addition to this, back in 1939, December, he was my best man, and in 1940, I was his best man in our respective marriage ceremonies. During the years 1946 to 53, the university had acquired additional housing units adjacent to the university through the Building Corporation and the foundation, in addition to the Badger Club houses, which were on Irving Court. An apartment, which is a rather large apartment, which stood at the corner of Park and University Avenues, across from Chadron Hall, was purchased, and several properties on Johnson Street, all of which were turned into temporary housing, mostly for married students, but there were the Women's Cooperative and a men's housing unit also established on the Johnson Street area. And on the lower campus, opposite the Armory, there was a unit also for graduate students. Of course, the greatest addition for married and faculty was the establishment of the building of the university houses out in the Alumni Research Foundation area, and the gift of the university, which was originally operated by the foundation. Of course, in later days, in addition to the trailers that were established on for married students over on Camp Randall, the visiting residence halls were making plans to build married student housing in the area along the lake towards the Forest Products Lab. In the meantime, they were operating the married housing at Truex Field and at Badger Ordnance, Badger Village at Baraboo. The policies of the Housing Bureau and University regarding placement and listings was that any listing made had to be available to any student who applied, and any attempt to discriminate on the basis of race or religion would remove the listing from the Housing Bureau files. It was noted that some of the private housing, group housing, that was established by operators who purchased fraternities catered mostly to out-of-state women students, and primarily because they seemed to come from an economic group that was better able to pay the rates which were charged by these units. And in addition, several of these houses attracted Jewish women students from the metropolitan areas of Philadelphia, New York, and Pittsburgh. I do not recall any serious problems in relationship to prejudice against black students during the years I was at the Housing Bureau. In addition to the services that I've been discussing for students, the Housing Bureau attempted to maintain a listing of accommodations for faculty and staff, both on the basis of rental and sale. And in addition, yes, particular aid were given to departments who were scheduling conferences at the university, both on and off campus. I believe one of the major services that were established and performed by the Housing Bureau was that of communication between students, faculty, staff, off-campus and on-campus operators for housing services that would aid these groups. Until the group housing listings and units were established, the many private home listings throughout the city of Madison made it possible to accommodate the enrollment that were coming to the university immediately after World War II. And as standards, policies, listing services, placement, inspection, and referrals, which are all part of the Housing Bureau operation, became known to the suppliers of housing, it was difficult to do other than merely list and refer students. In the summer, the enrollment was heavily loaded with women students, and particularly those from out of state. The Housing Bureau compiled and published a bulletin for that listed all accommodations for women students, and on an approved basis. This was done for all private and university operations. This in itself generated a considerable amount of correspondence, as did our listing facilities for the regular fall and spring terms, semesters. Some random thoughts about people, places, things while I was at the university 40 years ago. I remember Professor Page in the law school, who taught contracts. He was beyond the retirement age, and it was said that he wrote his own contract so he could stay as long as he liked. He would stop at the union desk daily. We played sort of a game. If I'd anticipate the paper he wanted and brought out the Capital Times, he would ask for the Stately Journal, if I brought out the journal, he would watch to see when I wasn't looking and say, "Young man, have you got time to sell me the Capital Times?" He would also eat in the cafeteria, usually at a table by himself, and to ensure some type of privacy, he would spread his handkerchief over the top of his head. I remember Dr. Burge, ex-president emeritus, who lived about three blocks down Langdon Street, who would stop in the union, at the union desk occasionally for a paper. And then on a cold, icy day, with his drooping mustache frosted, another faculty person said to him, "You shouldn't be out in such a dangerous day with the icy walks." He said, didn't bother him because he had his creepers on. His creepers were a set of wedges that were strapped on his feet to grip the ice. He walked to the bath to Bascom Hall or to his office over in the hydraulics lab almost every day. I remember the excitement that was generated by the President Frank hearings at the time his presidency was being challenged, and the national press that came to cover these hearings. This must have been in 1936. I recall watching John Stuart Curry paint farm animals in the stock pavilion. Also, a midget by the name of Meinhard Raabe, R-A-A-B-E, who was about 50 inches high and couldn't have weighed more than 60 pounds, dressed in his Philip Morris costume, or I should say bellhop uniform. He was famous for the calling Philip Morris. Pictured taking his opening a car door for Joseph E. Davis, ambassador to Russia, who was an alumnus, who was visiting the campus. August Eckhart, was a Mack House resident, and later professor in the law school. Charles Gillette was a regent and alumni president and from La Crosse, who lived at the Student Union during his days as a student, as did Dick Brazeau and Don Griswold. I recall working on a ski slide at Muir Knoll, packing snow for one of the ski jumps when the Bietla brothers were jumping for Wisconsin. They were either from Iron Mountain or Espimie, Michigan. I recall Ed Fleming one summer or spring throwing all the daily Cardinals into the Lake Mendota before they were delivered because of some campus political program which he didn't agree with. One of the things that you had to do if you were a student of Wisconsin was just skate across Lake Mendota, or boat across Lake Mendota, or both, if you were going to have something to remember about the lake. We often skated and boated on Mendota. I recall in an American literature class of Henry Hayden Clark, a real Professor Punster, saying, "Today we shall try to get some pleasure from pain." It was in this class that I met my wife, the girl sitting next to me, agreed to share in purchase of half of the book list which Professor Clark had handed out, which was something in the order of 5 or 6 books, which amounted to considerable at that point. I was married in December 1939 to Charlotte Fitzgerald, a young lady from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, in the Newman Club on State Street. And Father Kuchera was the Catholic chaplain, who we affectionately called Coochie. I played freshman football at Wisconsin in the fall of 1935, and remember that John O'Brien, Howard Weiss, who later was president of the class of 1939, Vince Garvey, Ray Bellin, and John Larkey were on that team. Larkey was a Mack House resident. I recall that after President Dykstra occupied the house in the University Heights area, he would have a tea once a month for students and faculty. It was catered by the Division of Residence Halls, and one of my responsibilities was to set up these teas at the house. When we returned to the university in 1946 after World War II in the fall, we had no place to live and were looking for a place for a couple of weeks or more, and while we were house hunting, we lived in the president's home at University Heights, because at that time President Fred was living on the campus in the house that he occupied as Dean of the College of Agriculture and Dean of the Graduate School. I think he continued to live in that house until after he retired. They were using the University Heights house as a guest house during that period. In 1948, I served on the University Centennial Committee, which was formed to plan for the 100th anniversary of the university. John Guy Fawkes was chairman. Clay Schoenfeldt was in charge of publicity and publications. Helen Hoyt was on that committee, professor. As a student, I had Helen Hoyt as my advisor, a charming person We used to call her the Lavender Lady because she continually wore lavender-colored clothes and hats. And you could see her on a cold day coming down the Bascom Hill in her large overcoat with a cape all in lavender. My job on the committee was to schedule housing and dates for conferences during the centennial year. One semester, I shared an apartment with five other men at the corner of State and Lake in the upper floor, or the top floor of the building which housed the Rennebaum Pharmacy. They were Eddie Jankowski, Neil Poole, Richie Allen, Tommy Newbar, and Johnny Budd. One semester of this is all I could stand. The Daily Cardinal offices were in the Student Union, so I got to know some of the people who were on that staff. Wally Drew was editor, Bob Taylor, Bob Chaplin, Ed Newman, Jim Doyle, all who became rather famous in their own right later on in journalism. In the summer of 1940, Elizabeth Waters Hall was the showplace as a new residence hall and very well done. After the summer session, when it was open for women students, the hall was used as a conference center, and the big conference that was held that summer was the Hydrobiology Symposium, which filled the building. And the highlight of the conference was a gala dinner and honorarium for President Emeritus Burge, which was managed by the Master of Ceremonies was E.B. Fred. During the early days of the Housing Bureau, the newspapers were very generous about running articles on how the veterans were making out and coming back to college. Also, the Housing Bureau prepared notices to be sent out to the churches, to the service groups. I made talks before service groups, Alumni Magazine, and the handouts that went along with correspondence on inquiries about housing. This set a pattern for communication between the townspeople of Madison, the people around the state, newspapers, and thereafter we made it a practice to keep all these elements of information going to the media. If the many private homes in Madison, who had never taken students before, hadn't come forth with offerings during the fall of 46 and 47, we'd have never been able to accommodate the number of students that wanted to return to college in those years. The following is a summary of the Housing Bureau's activities. Listing and finding of housing for students. Inspection of housing units. Providing educational program for housing units. Other landlord relationships. Advertising and providing information on the summer sessions. Listing housing for faculty and notifying them of availability. Assignments to university houses. Listing of faculty members' houses who will be on leave, making personal referrals. Keeping statistical records. Preparing reports on housing needs. Working with conference and groups who need special housing. Prepared an annual report to the trustee, to the regions on fraternity and sorority housing. Keeping the general faculty, students, and local population aware of the housing situation. In 1940, the Men's Residence Halls Student Government founded a service honorary fraternity known as Delta Epsilon. I was a charter member of the fraternity, along with other staff and faculty, Dr. Harold Bradley, Lee Burns, Arnie Damon, Don Elverson, Professor Otto Kowalki, and Norris Wentworth. In the first 20 years, there were 303 men elected to this fraternity. And I assume after that, the chapter and the total fraternity membership has grown. There were from 10 to 25 members elected each year. During the World War II years, Don Elverson and Lee Burns sent out a newsletter to all housing, to all residence halls fellows, and exchange their letters and passed on information on sort of a digest of round robin letters. This practice has continued, and I assume it still is. From time to time, one or two newsletters a year have been sent out by the Division of Residence Halls to their former fellows, keeping the former fellow up to date with what their friends and associates are doing out in the world. After listening to the tape this far, I note a couple corrections. One, Bill Exum, the black student who worked with me on the toboggan slide, graduated in 1936. He was a track man and a sprinter. And Meinhardt Robb was in the class of 1937. In addition, I remember that Porter Butts had the sketch drawings for the Paul Bunyan mural and returned them to Jim Watrous. Jim Watrous gave them to me and signed them before I received them. I now have them framed in my study in State College. Barry, I hope this tape will be helpful to you. I'm sorry that it's not organized very well. I found it difficult to recall many of the incidents that may have been better detailed. Good luck. The photographs that I've enclosed, you're welcome to use if you can, and if you don't, please return them to me. The report on the of the Advisory Committee on the Housing Bureau need not be returned. Thank you.